This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Perhaps one of the most iconic images of the BP oil spill was the live stream feed of SpillCam, an aperture to the ruptured pipeline gushing oil from the deep sea. BP was pressured to make SpillCam footage public on May 12, 2010, nearly a month after the first explosion, which occurred on Earth Day, because of growing distrust over BP's estimates of how much oil was actually leaking from the damaged well. Extrapolating from observable features of the video feed, experts with knowledge of fluid dynamics were then able to make their own estimates about how much oil was leaking from the well. After all, as one CNN article put it, quote, "live video doesn't lie." For millions of lay viewers, SpillCam footage gave the ongoing leakage a sense of immediacy and reflected a particular obsession with origins, the desire to literally get to the bottom of the disaster and require better transparency from British Petroleum, obligated to give us a window into their efforts to cap the well. Compared with the SpillCam feed, imprinted on the collective memory of so many Americans, there is no equivalently iconic image of Corexit, a toxic surfactant used to disperse the oil, perhaps because it was so effective in making the oil disappear in the first place. As Daniel Cressy colloquially explains in the journal Nature, surfactants, quote, "work on the same principle as kitchen washing up liquids. Both are made up primarily of surfactant molecules, which have heads that are attracted to water and tails that are repelled by water. Corexit was intended as a kind of magic effect, an untested way to make oil disappear, to hide it, to sink it out of sight, turning the Gulf into, quote, a giant science experiment." In his observations of the disaster in the Tarball Chronicles, David Gessner writes that, quote, "the immediate effect of the chemical Corexit is first to disperse the oil and then sink it to the ocean floor. This makes short-term sense to anyone like BP who wants to tamp down immediate panic about the spill, since it means that less oil will be washing up on the beaches in a region that depends on tourism more than any other industry." It is no coincidence, then, that the subject substance Corexit largely avoided the media spotlight in favor of the more spectacular images, like SpillCam's 24/7 footage of spewing oil, the fiery rig, or the oiled pelican. These images came to constitute a spectacular but familiar scene in the public consciousness, creating us as virtual witnesses keyed into the ongoing disaster of the flowing wound. In my talk today, I take interest in photographer Daniel Belcher's collection called Spill, because it documents not only the spectacle of spilled oil, but importantly, the vibrant spaces of contact between oil and Corexit, mixtures that seem to glow in orange and bright green clouds in the ocean. As a meditation on Corexit, the photos in Spill offer new ways of thinking about residual media, which is Charles Ackland's term, in a way that not only is about the objects that are left behind, but also about the stickiness of liquid media in the milieu of the ocean. To link a liquid sense of the residual with media may seem transgressive to those who think or insist that media is primarily about recording, transmission, and storage of information patterns. Yet an older sense of the term medium, as John Guillory points out, has to do with milieu and environment, or that which exists in between. It is from this environmental sense of the term medium that John Durham Peters has recently made a case for environments performing the work of communication infrastructures that are not so ontologically different from man-made technologies. The aesthetics of Spill and their dramatization of the materiality of Corexit lead me to consider the logic of liquids that cut. This phrase should surprise us, since the most common ways of understanding the meaning of to cut are as a kind of mark on a hard surface, or a slice into the skin, or the click of a camera aperture slicing off a moment in time. Although the phrase cuts grease exists in ordinary language, especially in the kitchen context, liquids that cut is still somewhat of a cognitively estranging phrase, to borrow a term from science fiction studies. Scholars working in the ocean humanities have pointed out that much of the way we speak about the world emerges from human embodiment and terrestrial life experience. For example, Dan Brayton has argued there is a, quote, deep encoding of the land in terminology and conceptual categories that define eco-critical inquiry, and that this, quote, profoundly limits our object of study and keeps us from reaching beneath the surface of what Mary Oliver calls the green, black, cobbled coat of the sea, unquote. Yet what interests me in tracking the phenomenon of liquids that cut is that it requires us to think about the material specificity of the ocean environment after the BP oil spill, but within the vocabulary that we have. Thus, rather than developing an entirely new ocean-specific vocabulary or set of neologisms, we can find instances of materially specific phrases that deliver a kind of sensorial jolt of discomfort. The notion of the fluid cut, which we can get to through Corexit and other dispersants, enacts a defamiliarization in language that immediately keys us into material processes swirling around the Deepwater Horizon spill. Daniel Balchos's photographic work is marked, so I'm going to go into his work now, is marked by its unique obsession with the geometry of unnatural disasters shot from an aerial view. The aerial view enables him to compose large-scale photographs that sublimely swirl with toxic color, trace the cross-hatched movements of tires on deforested red soil, or freeze the cottony patterns of blue rivulets threading across melting sea ice. In an artist's statement on his website, he writes, "The fragility of our ecosystems is a continuous thread throughout my work. My photographs show the vast scale of transformation our world is under from human-made stresses. To capture this, I often work from the air, which more easily allows for the juxtaposition of nature with the destruction wrought by unsustainable development." Although the aerial view has been criticized for its complicity with the bomb's eye view and what Donna Haraway has called the God trick or view from nowhere, in Beltras's work, it functions somewhat differently. Beltras seems to approach photographic subjects with more of an eye towards texture rather than portraiture, where the viewer would be forgiven for mistaking his photographs for something like microscopic slides. Indeed, Beltras' aerial photographs function almost like macro photography in their intimacy and obsession with the detailed skin of a landscape in ways that most viewers would not have anticipated. Unlike the spectacular quality of spill cam and other images of the disaster, like the fire explosion of the oil rig that centered on the origin of the oil itself exploding and free-flowing, Beltras' photographs approach the swirling waters at the periphery. The hardcover publication of this work, Spill, which I still have up here, invites a variety of tactile and haptic interactions. Its broad cover consists of a textured fabric printed with what appears to be an abstractly geometric orange and navy blue pattern reminiscent of camouflage. The title page uses a sans-serif boneless font as if parts of the letters have sunken into the page. The sequence of photographs in Spill seems to deny the viewer a firm grasp of the situation. Although the viewer knows these photographs are of the Deepwater Horizon spill, the first few images do not resemble the conventional images of the disaster at all. Indeed, the first image is particularly hard to interpret without context. Spanning two pages, it shows a royal blue backdrop with dark striations. Thick diagonal pathways cut across the page, the largest bordered in fluorescent orange. There are no objects in the image that would anchor the photograph to a particular scale, and we are left uncertain as to what made the broad cuts on the page and how it did so. The second image is even more disorienting. Across a background of what the viewer assumes to be smooth blue ocean water occur rusty orange striations that stream down the page. The third image finally grants a scalar reference point. On the left-hand side, we see, as if in miniature, a crystal-clear oil rig and a ship docked at its side. It seems to be floating, toy-like, with no visible anchoring. Around the rig swirl surreal blooms of some kind of phosphorescent green light amidst dark, inky stains of what we assume is oil, were it not for the colorful rust-red patches. What made these colors? We are used to seeing photos of oil spills with rainbow sheens, but not the solid, opaque colors that appear here. The fifth image finally shows us what made the cuts in the first image, a large ship. The ship cuts across the top of the page, its wake outlined with a light kind of fluorescence, parting the redness in the sea. Perhaps this is what made the previous cuts across the photos, the wakes of passing ships. And upon closer inspection, if you were to look a little closer, that this resolution is a bit difficult, we can see that it's actually sprained something. It's not until Barbara Bloeming's essay at the end of the book that the viewer learns of the connection between the ship that cuts through the photograph, sprained something, and the vibrant colors in each image. As Bloeming writes, quote, many strategies were used to clean up the oil. The most obvious were the 411 controlled burns. Some of these are visible in Belcher's photographs, with huge noxious plumes of inky smoke rise out of red-hot fires on the surface of the water. But more controversial and ultimately more destructive than the fires was the use of the toxic chemical Corexit, originally used to break up surface tension of the oil and help it disperse. Flying over the spill, planes disperse between 23,000 and 25,000 gallons per day of the substance over the sections of the ocean blanketed by oil. In the end, over 1.8 million gallons of Corexit were used, despite its toxic nature. Belcher captures the prolonged effects of the oil and Corexit and how they mix beautifully in his composed, poignant images. The representational contradiction in the photographs is that the bright colors we see are not signs of life, like a kind of algae bloom might be, but are in fact the results of Corexit mixing with oil and seawater to produce a toxic ocean-wide oil painting, in a sort of literal sense. Bloeming's essay goes on to note how in both literal painting and photographs, chemicals are mixed with oil to, quote, create extraordinary unexpected colors. In some works in the Spill series, the greenish-yellow colors resulting from the mixing chemicals with crude oil and water glow with natural fluorescence. In others, the Corexit spreads across the work surface like long serpentine brushstrokes of red. And since there are no captions for the full-length photographs, Bloeming's essay at the end of the book acts as a kind of extended caption, anchoring, in Roland Barthes' sense, our interpretation of the photographs. Given that none of Beltrice's photographs center on the Macondo rig itself in its spectacular explosion, it's possible to read Spill as a photo essay, not about petroleum itself, but about the slow violence of Corexit. The materiality of Corexit suggests a new way of thinking about the relationship between photography and the cut. If the cut has been primarily imagined as a partitioning of reality enacted by the click of the camera shutter, capturing that which occurs only once, it acts like a sort of knife-like sense of the cut. This is consistent with Walter Benjamin's famous comparison of painting to magic and photography to surgery, as the operation of cutting into reality with mechanical equipment, opening an unconscious optics that would otherwise pass too quickly for our notice. In reference to Latourian networks, Marilyn Strathern offers a different sense of the network cut as the end of the enumeration of actors or actants. For example, a cut is enacted when certain authors are listed on a patent, but not others, the network of actors coming to a halt when something is turned into property. In contrast to both senses of the cut as a kind of halting or as a slice, Spill suggests a different sense of the cut, the chemical cut. After all, how does one cut through oil to break up the residue and make it go away? Beltrice's photographs time and again frame the work of Corexit as a chemical that cuts across the oil we see on each oceanic page. Each page thus involves material-specific forms of cutting. The photographic cuts that frame the pages, as well as the chemical cuts made by the wakes of the boats spraying Corexit. Thus, oil is not only residue of the Deepwater Horizon spill. What Beltrice's photographs so visibly document are the residues of Corexit itself, which kind of ironically is a homophone for correct it. David Gessner's account of the BP oil spill in the Tarball Chronicles offers further meditations on the nature of Corexit as a substance that cuts. From his observations in Louisiana shortly after the spill, Gessner notes that, quote, napalm is one local name for Corexit, the chemical that they spray. Another is Agent Orange, in part for the way it stains the water and shore. Such a comparison makes the brightness of the orange cover of Spill even more harrowing. And indeed, another way that Spill links to the chemical Corexit is through color. Midway through Spill is a highly geometric photograph of the oil sheen in islands. It is this photo that serves as a template for the bright orange and blue cover, the camouflage, the cover that looks like camouflage, but with the colors inverted. Thus, the cover is a kind of photographic negative or inverse of the original photo, where the orange seems to denote clear, clean ocean, and dark blue seems to map onto areas of the oil slick. By highlighting orange so vibrantly on the cover, Belcher offers a strong signifying link then with the color of Corexit, or as is also known, Agent Orange. Yet cleanup efforts were caught in the contradiction of having to use oil to clean up oil. Gessner notes that it's, quote, hard not to notice how much oil is being used to clean up the spilled oil itself. Helicopters are coming and going constantly from the pads. Every morning, hundreds of cars, quote, pour south towards the harbor, all going from roughly the same origin to the same destination, from their homes and hotels in the north to the harbor in the south, but none of them doing anything as unmanly as carpooling. This extraordinary use of oil to clean up oil is precisely what Spill both documents and participates in. Much like Ishmael's realization in Moby Dick that he is writing about whaling under the light of the lamp used using whale oil, Belcher's photographs in Spill were taken in a small Cessna plane, a vehicle running on oil, whose vantage point provided the conditions of possibility for the overhead point of view for all of the photographs throughout Spill. So although Beltros' camera may seem to document the spill from a distance, the grim reality is that the photographs of oil mixed with Corexit are themselves part of the petroculture that they seek to measure and document. This entanglement of the photographic apparatus and phenomenon that it is supposedly documents recalls Karen Barad's theorization of ethics and entanglement in Meeting the Universe Halfway. For Barad, 20th century quantum physics provides a new series of case studies, or better, primal scenes, for a realist ethics of relationality. In her realist account, measuring apparatuses are not separate from the things that they purport to measure, but are, quote, boundary-drawing practices and, quote, specific material reconfigurations of the world which come to matter. For example, an apparatus that measures momentum of an atom by shooting it with another particle is part of the same phenomenon as that atom. The apparatus only seems as if it is apart from the atom because it enacts an agential cut within the phenomena. If we may extend Barad's sense of the apparatus from physics to include contemporary photography and cameras, a similar situation appears to emerge. The condition of possibility for the oil spill, as well as the photographic documentation of the oil spill from the air, not to mention the cleaning up of it, is perhaps the whole of petroculture itself in its destructive and energetic possibilities. Indeed, the ethical contradiction that almost all of us live with today is that to do any kind of energy-expending work touches petroleum. This situational entanglement, where photographic documentation of the spill is dependent on oil for its condition of possibility, is perhaps a fitting instance of Barad's model of how apparatuses belong to phenomena they purportedly observe. To use Barad's term, the camera apparatus enacts an agential cut, to name another form of cutting, that shows us the oil spill as if from a distance. The ethical question inspired by then Sarah Kember and Joanna Zielinska is, deciding how to act within the phenomena of petroculture and how to agentially cut well, as they put it. The fluid cut is one of many species of cuts, albeit an overlooked one, that participated in the durational violence of the BP oil spill. In the Tarball Chronicles, Gessner further highlights the series of corporate cuts used to reduce operating costs and limit inspections that were largely responsible for the spill. Here we may think of the board of BP as part of the extractive apparatus that led to the spill through its own cuts. The board decided that, quote, to provide billions of dollars, a 25% cut in operations had to be enacted, even as operations were expanding downward into new territory, 13,000 feet below the ocean floor. Gessner rightly asks, quote, how were those cuts enacted? Simply and systematically, by cutting corners and skipping regulations and eliminating safety measures. So this third form of cut, the regulatory cut, belies every image and spill, even as they are cut through by Corexit, the wakes of passing ships, and the action of the camera's shutter. However, some photographic cuts can play with spatiality in productively disoriented ways. In one image from the middle of the collection, Belcher frames the photograph so as to position a line of oil horizontally across the top of the page in such a way that evokes gentle waves on the surface of the sea. This effect is enhanced because there's a boat that sits right on the crest of one of the waves, And the second boat seems as if it's taking a vertical dive into the water column, with the top of the photograph as the sky and the bottom as deeper water. This effect is even more estranging because the second boat seems to cut down the page, leaving a wake like a plunge. Perhaps this evokes this hubristic sort of sense of drilling the oil from the bottom of the seafloor that got us into this mess in the first place. So the last photograph in Spill is somewhat of an outlier. A cluster of oiled pelicans stands against an oiled wood background, their expressive marble eyes seeming to stare back right at the viewer, and this actually works really well with our earlier talk. It is the only image in the collection of a life form, and the only photograph taken as a close-up in a kind of portraiture, rather than the distances we saw with the other aerial shots. Bloeming's essay at the end notes that, quote, the pelicans have just been treated, causing the oil to wash off their bodies and drip into the formerly white cloth beneath. On the one hand, intervention is helping alleviate a dangerous situation. On the other, the photograph depicts only a handful of birds, calling to mind all those the rescuers did not get to in time. Gessner has expressed a rather similar sentiment in the Tarball Chronicles, but his is a bit different. Quote, pelicans, particularly the oiled variety, have become the media darlings of the Spill. And while gannets and laughing gulls and tricolored herons must bristle with resentment, Pelicanus occidentalis has claimed the center stage. In my head, I have come to call whatever the biggest, latest accepted story is, the oiled pelican. The oiled pelican is anything obvious or anyone who tries to treat anything in our messy world in a simple, obvious way. So that's supposed to be a joke there. What Gessner calls the myth of the oiled pelican is about the superficiality of certain iconic images. So he notes the irony of the day when the media selectively broadcasted images of beaches without oil such that the oiled pelican, or the latest accepted story, was that there were no more oiled pelicans. Oiled pelicans, however, quickly lead us to a related story of another surfactant that cuts grease, Dawn liquid dish soap. So at the time of writing this, under the ash of the fire cloud, a particular video ad kept appearing on my smartphone, probably a case of targeted marketing. If we could play that ad real quick, please.
These birds, once affected by oil, are heading back home, thanks to Dawn. Rescue workers only trust Dawn because it's tough on grease and gentle.
So I realize this is just in time for Easter. And it's really cute, right? So Dawn's ad campaigns are marked by the desire to disassociate dish soap with the caring hands of the mother, while concealing all images of originary originary sources of trauma that led to the necessity of rescuing really cute ducklings in the first place. In the ad home, for example, the infrastructure of petroculture and toxicity of oil have receded to the background in the favor of the hygienic space of the bathtub, a recovery narrative whose associations with maternity, nature, and home could not be more deliberate. As we are shown suffering we are never shown suffering animals, only ducklings being gently held in sudsy bathtubs, a space that American viewers would automatically associate with the rubber ducky. The bathtub naturalizes the duck as denizen, and the oil spill exists only within the space of the off-screen. The Dawn Saves Wildlife ad campaign began in 2009, decades after it was identified by rescue workers as the most effective soap for cleaning animals affected by oil. According to the New York Times, quote, in 1978, Alice Berkner, founder of the International Bird Rescue Research Center, which helps birds harmed by oil spills, secured a small grant from Chevron to test all major dish soaps for cleaning birds. Because Dawn cut the oil faster than anything else, the IBRRC informed Dawn's parent company, Procter & Gamble, informed them of this, but they initially ignored requests to donate cases of the product, only finally agreeing to do so in 1988. Now, however, Dawn works with the International Bird Rescue and Marine Mammal Center, both based out of California, to treat wildlife. And according to one video on their website, not every use of Dawn is in the context of an oil spill. Some animals they treat become coated with motor oil, poured into storm drains, which ended up in wetlands, a more mundane form of violence. In contrast to the lingering toxicity of Corexit, Dawn has gradually branded itself as a beneficial surfactant that is, quote, tough on grease, not on hands or wildlife. Dawn has also commissioned short documentaries that discuss things like avian science and the physiology of feathers. Episode 1 of the documentary series The Big Picture is entitled Duck Duck Oil, a name that draws associations with duck duck goose. The substituting of oil for goose is perhaps unintentionally fitting as an expression of petriculture. After all, within the diegetic world of the game, the person who is it chooses a goose, oil, and then the goose chases down the person that tagged them. If the goose, or oil, fails to catch the person who is it, they become the new it, and the cycle repeats. The game never ends. There is always a goose, or oil, that is chasing the person who is it. The eternal return of Duck Duck Oil belies a particular contradiction in Dawn's marketing strategy that positions Dawn soap as the cure for oiled animals. One article in the Washington Post highlights this. Quote, some people, however, are not feeling particularly warm and bubbly towards Dawn. Because Dawn is a petroleum-based soap, critics are concerned that bird rescue groups are fighting oil with oil. Ben Busby Collins, the founder and chief executive of Ballard Organic Soap Inc., says, quote, if we're trying to reduce our demand for oil and you're using a petroleum-based product, it's just creating more demand. Thus, even though it would seem that Dawn benignly cleans fluffy ducklings of oily residues, it derives its material properties from petroleum, sharing a complicity with petroculture at large. It is an irony that one cleanup worker reported being told that the smelly residue on the floor of one floating hotel hosting cleanup workers during the BP spill was, quote, as safe as Dawn dishwashing liquid, and then experienced a series of very serious, inexplicable health problems. As a petroleum product that simultaneously brands itself as treatment for petroleum-coated wildlife, Dawn, like Corexit, is a kind of pharmacon, both poison and cure, materially tied into ecologies of oil. Surfactants come into view during disasters like the Deepwater Horizon spill as antidotes to toxic oil spills, sinking oil that would muck up beaches, bird wings, and surfaces back down into the water column for microbes to handle. Although one study shows that mixes of Corexit and oil are more toxic to rotifers than just the oil alone. As Stephanie Lemenager writes in Living Oil, quote, there is a significant continuity to how spill remediation fails, down to the use of the same toxic surfactant, Corexit, from the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill, where the Sierra Club demanded its discontinuance, and in multiple spills up through the BP blowout. If Corexit is a failed instance of environmental remediation, it may nonetheless be productive of shifting our sense of media and mediation to the agency of liquids. Because of their enduring environmental presence in the protracted event of the oil spill, surfactants like Corexit and Dawn should be paradigmatic examples of residual media. The word residual suggests a kind of tackiness, a liquid remainder that is difficult to clean up and whose viscous porosity, to borrow Nancy Tuana's term, might leak into the bodily boundaries, such was the fear of eating seafood after the spill. Attention to liquidity departs from conventional senses of the residue, as we see in Charles Ackland's edited collection, Residual Media, from 2014, where residual media are those older or even obsolete media or cultural formations that endure, channeling critical attention away from a myopic focus on new and emerging media technologies. Building on Raymond Williams' discussion of social formations that have been effectively formed in the past but are still active in the cultural process, Charles Ackland repurposes the residual to think about the relationship between old and new media technologies. In this way, residual media complements media archaeology as a term that encourages media scholars to focus less myopically on the newness of new media. Although some of the essays in residual media engage with environmental problems like hardware obsolescence and waste, what is missing is an engagement with the slipperiness of actual residues. Thus, instead of primarily theorizing the residual in terms of temporality or what is left behind, we might also consider the residual even more materially in terms of its liquid valences. Corexit, in its transformations, is one of the residues of the spill event. So as a residual medium that degrades oil, corrects it defies more normative definitions of media as that which transmits, stores, or processes information. Instead, corrects it acts as a kind of failed remediation element for ecological cleanup. Yet the failed remediation of Corexit requires attention to its agential specificity as a surfactant that disorganizes the structure of oil. Indeed, Corexit does something that the English language barely has a term for. It cuts, as in cuts grease. So if we follow this almost counterintuitive sense of the liquid that cuts, the essential logic of the surfactant, then we arrive at a dispersive imaginary that is symptomatic of what I have theorized elsewhere as negative mediation, or processes that undo an environment's informatic storage, foreclosing possibilities of recording and persistence. Negative mediation keys us into processes of disintegration rather than media objects and infrastructures, of organizational undoing and erasure. If the Anthropocene has been dominated by discussions of new geologic strata in anthropogenic formation, what has been repressed is a sense of Anthropocene processes of disintegration and disappearance. Well, this has resonances with actually Kate's talk yesterday, including species extinctions, ocean acidification, deforestation, glacial melting, and more. Surfactants thus belong to the logic of negative mediation, cutting away even the thickest of historical residues. However, even though Corexit was intended to clean up the oil, it actually slowed down naturally occurring microbial oil biodegradation, an effect of the ocean's rare biosphere of microbes that kicks into gear whenever an uncommon event occurs. So as someone who is getting used to living in Santa Barbara now, it's actually quite fascinating that microbes naturally occur in the ocean to degrade oil. They're a small percentage of the total population, so they can't handle big spills, but in areas that have natural seepage, like Santa Barbara, they're there and they're an active presence. So in addition, the heavy use of dispersants introduced one other problem that was particularly aggravating for scientists, not being able to track where the oil actually went in the ocean, and thus who or what it potentially affected. So to conclude, our cultural dependency on oil and our failed remediation of oil spills through surfactants suggests a version of the Anthropocene anchored not in the science of geology, but in the science of chemistry. I think I have one more picture. Yeah, I'll just return to this one. Chemistry turns attention to material changes in the composition of seawater and atmosphere that will not necessarily take the form of future strata, but instead involve the reconfiguration of metabolic relationships. Think of how oil spills, ocean acidification, and microplastics constitute a new oceanic environment, not marked, but saturated by economic activities of capitalist modernity. So I read spill within the context of something like Anthropocene chemistry for the role that surfactants play in the ongoing slow violence in the Gulf of Mexico. Through a naturally sharp colors and disorienting play with scale, Daniel Beltras unsettles what we expect images of the Deepwater Horizon spill to look like. Instead of the fiery explosion or the 24-hour-a-day feed of oil spewing from the bottom of the ocean, his photographs depict a sort of alien meditation on the complexity of the surface as a site of mixing between seawater, oil, and corexit. Yet the swirl of unnatural colors and spill invites us to confront the surface as a limit to the imagination and wonder about the residual mixes that saturate the three-dimensional water column of the Gulf into the bodies of microbes, plankton, fish, and us. Spill reminds us that in our quest for a substance to remediate the toxicity of oil, there are, as of yet, no perfect solutions.